This is the Marketing Podcast Network. You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Welcome to Uncorking a Story, the podcast that introduces you to the rich world of storytellers who share their personal journeys, creative processes, and the stories behind their stories, one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Mike Carlin, and I'm thrilled to be part of your writing journey. If you're an aspiring writer, a literary enthusiast, or simply someone who believes in the transformative power of words, you've come to the right place. Every week, we'll pop the cork on the world of successful storytellers and give you a healthy pour of inspiration, insight, and empowerment. My mission is to help writers like you realize your full potential through the transformative and therapeutic power of writing. Whether you're just starting your literary voyage or looking to refine your craft, I'm here to provide you with the knowledge, inspiration, and encouragement you need to embark on your own storytelling adventure. So, are you ready to uncork your story and let your creativity flow? Uncorking a Story is about to begin. Sit back, relax, and let the transformative magic of storytelling whisk you away. Welcome to Uncorking a Story. Gail Marlene Schwartz is a writer living in Montpelier, Vermont. She is the author of four books and is the co-editor of a forthcoming collection of essays about queer moms parenting sons. A writer who seeks and often finds humor, beauty, and meaning in the mundane, Gail writes about parenthood, identity, love, childhood, immigration, social change, health and illness, breaches and repairs, and food. Always food. She joins me today on Uncorking a Story to talk about her life and latest novel, Falling Through the Night. Welcome to Uncorking a Story, Gail.
Thank you so much, Mike. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here, Gail. I'm curious, where does your story as an author begin?
Well, it's a really, really fun question for me because it did not begin well. I believe I was 4 or 5 years old, and I was the identified patient in my family. So I was a tantrum-y, highly expressive little being. And my parents decided I needed to go see a counselor, and I didn't like this. And it was this gentleman who was old, and I thought he was ugly, and I hated him, and they would sort of drag me in there kicking and screaming. And the first time they took me, I remember looking around, and he had one of those easels, you know, those child-sized painting easels. And what I did was I picked it up, and I put it down directly in front of my chair so I wouldn't have to look at him. And bless his heart, he was very patient with me. So he continued to ask me the question, so how are you feeling? Which, of course, irked me. I just wanted to rip his friggin' face off. So at one point, he had some art supplies on the side. And I remember I picked up a pad and I think I was doodling. Because this happened over a series of many sessions. It was not just the first one. And he asked me that question again. And I remember taking the pen and writing the word M-A-D. And then I sort of like tossed it under the easel at him. And then he wrote back. And that started our connection. And he stopped talking to me. He would write, we would pass notes underneath the easel. And eventually I came out and we became friends. And it was actually a wonderful relationship. And I think that was the thing that kind of turned my brain toward writing as a tool for connection.
Wow. How old were you at the time?
I think I was either 4 or 5 in my mind. I'm not exactly sure, but I was very, very young. It was before I went to kindergarten.
Wow. It's note therapy.
Yeah. It was funny. I was a bit of a drama queen, but he was great. He just sort of had all the materials, and, you know, I sort of gravitated toward what was most natural to me.
Wow. All right. So that's kind of where it begins. And then when did you sort of realize that, you know, you kind of had a knack for writing.
Well, I journaled through most of my childhood and adolescence, and I started writing stories, I think, in my early teens. And I actually had an idea for a novel. I think I was maybe in eighth grade, and I wrote it. And it was about, it's embarrassing, but it's about two twin girls who switch places. And of course, you know, Disney copied my idea, and it was so frustrating. Yeah, it was very silly, but it was like 150 pages. So it was a pretty serious endeavor for someone of that age. And I also remember I was a big Peanuts fan, Snoopy and Linus and Charlie Brown. And yeah, so that was a big thrill. And my best friend, Deborah, and I, we wrote, that was my first collaborative writing project. Now I'm realizing that, but we wrote a story using the characters and we sent it off to Charles Schulz. That was younger than the novel, but he or one of his assistants actually wrote back and we were thrilled, and they had pictures of the characters with his autograph. And it was sort of, we had sort of touched somebody very special.
Oh, that's so cool. They had. Do you by any chance still have that 150 page book that you wrote?
I don't. I wish I did, but I don't know what happened to it.
Now, it wasn't entitled the Parent Trap, was it? Because that would just be too too coincidental. Yeah.
No, I think it was entitled Switch.
Okay. Well, that's it's a better title in my book.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's, you know, very comforting in the, you know, wake of all the money that I lost by not,
yeah. Although, you know, depending on what genre it's written in, Switch has, you know, different,
That's true. Very great.
You never know who's going to pick up a book entitled Switch.
That's true. It could be a good marketing ploy.
So, so your teens, you know, you're writing, you're journaling, you're kind of getting more involved in the written word. What do you decide to do when it comes to higher education? Like what were you thinking your career might be when you were a teenager?
Well, I ended up getting into the school newspaper and the school yearbook and anything having to do with writing. My family was very conservative and their advice for career was more about being practical. So I had to be practical, and I decided I would major in English because I could still become a lawyer or a teacher if I did that. But I really, really, really wanted to write professionally. And I did have a conversation with one of my professors, and she said she found that I was very talented, but it's a very hard life, and she strongly recommended against it. So I think that actually, in retrospect, it had more to do with her and her experience with her career. But I actually ended up going, after graduating, I did some temp work and I traveled, and I ended up going to law school, which is not something I tell that many people. But I
feel honored. That was,
yeah, you should. And strangely enough, I actually learned a lot about how to write expository writing in law school, and how to structure things and how to understand structure and the idea of a skeleton of a piece. I really perfected those skills. Even as an English major, I don't have a particularly organized brain. So that training really enabled me to learn those skills. And I apply those all the time, both as a college teacher who teaches writing and also as a professional editor.
Yeah.
So strangely enough, it didn't make me become a lawyer, but it actually gave me a lot of skills that were much more practical than creative writing that did help you as a writer and editor.
I've probably talked to, we're in the double digits now, well over 10 lawyers who pivoted and became novelists, you know, published, you know, and then now make their career writing. Some of them still practice law because, you know, as we know, you know, unless your last name is King or Patterson or Rowling, you know, some of us don't make a big living, you know, off the written word. So they still practice. But I have found there is a huge overlap between creative writing and legal writing, you know, especially people who are structuring arguments to present in front of people. You know, there's definitely overlap there.
Yeah. And it certainly helps even outside of the novel writing process, just writing in general. and understanding that where you're coming from is very different than where the reader is coming from. And you really need to put up, you know, flags and structural signposts and all of that, that definitely came from law school. And it's funny, actually, a classmate of mine became a novelist. So it's just interesting what you're saying, that even just in my small class, there's somebody who I know who she did well. Her name's Rishi Reddy, or it was, I don't know.
Did you ever practice law?
I worked for legal aid in Burlington, Vermont for, I think, about 18 months under a grant, but I didn't pass the bar and I ended up deciding I just didn't want to do it. Yeah. So I didn't end up taking the bar a second time.
Yeah. So then what did you do after that?
After that, what did I do? Well, I was actually doing some theater workshops and teaching piano, because that's another area of interest, which I was told was not very practical. And I was working in the summertime doing camp counseling, and I was an accompanist at a summer camp. And then I was teaching at a private school, teaching private piano lessons, and then also doing after school theater projects. And I teamed up with a man who became my partner later on, and we ran a company and we wrote plays and produced them. So there was writing in that project as part of, you know, and we were also writing grants and doing funding initiatives and lots of expository writing along with the creative aspect. So I did that for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, I believe. And that was really a lot of fun. And then I started teaching at the community college where I am now. And I started off as an academic advisor and then started teaching theater. Then they needed a writing instructor. And I was like, oh, I can do that. And that became really a big part of my life pretty quickly. So now and then I was able to build my editing skills through work with the students, which enabled me later on after my son was born to start a freelance copywriting and editing business, which is what I'm doing now.
So there you are. So it really is childhood dream kind of come true. Maybe not in a direct line, but certainly, you know, it happened on its terms, and maybe not your terms, but it happened on its terms as life happens with us, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's a good description.
So tell me about when publishing came into your life, specifically publishing novels. I know we're going to talk about Falling Through the Night, but I know you've written some other things as well. So talk to me about that part of your life.
Well, I actually started submitting short stories and essays after my son was born. I made the decision that that was something that I really had wanted to do. And I was writing a lot of stories about queer motherhood and parenting with anxiety and dealing with mental health challenges. And it's interesting because I had twins and I gave one away for adoption who was born with Down syndrome. And I wrote an essay about that. And it was the first thing I sent out and it got accepted to an anthology, which was the first place I sent it to. And that's really unheard of. It just doesn't usually happen that way. And they loved it. They sort of fell in love with it. And the editors wrote me this incredibly sort of gushing email. And it was really like all roses. And I just had this sort of idea of, oh, well, that's really easy. And so I just started sending lots of, and it did not happen that way every time. But I did publish a bunch of creative nonfiction essays and several short stories to literary journals, both in Canada and the US. And I was thinking after about 3 or 4 years of having a bunch of stories and essays out there in journals that it would be great to maybe to put a book together. And the most obvious collection seemed to me to be this collection of stories about queer motherhood and parenting with anxiety. And that actually, before that, let me just backtrack a little bit, because the pandemic happened. And that was actually, ironically, another strange way that the first three books that I was involved with publishing came to pass. My ex and I were separated at the time, and she was Canadian and I was living in Vermont half time and we shared a home. And as soon as the pandemic happened, we found out that the border was going to be closing. So I had to make a decision. And we had, at the time, a 9 or 10 year old. And I decided I was going to go to Canada because there's no way I didn't want to be without him or have that border issue come between us. So, you know, we were like everybody, we were kind of holed up. And I was in conversation with one of the, I was doing some volunteer work for the homeschooling organization. And she mentioned something like, oh, she had a publishing company and she was saying, yeah, we really want to do some kind of children's book about the pandemic, but I don't know, we just can't really find anyone to write it. And so I said, well, maybe Lucy and I can write it. And she said, really? And I said, yeah, let me talk with her. And, you know, we weren't doing much. I was doing my remote work. Lucy was parenting and she had been retired at that point. We were lots of hanging out time. So I said, do you want to give it a whirl? And she said, yes. She's a retired librarian. And we did not know what we were doing. It was a high low chapter book. So this is for a very specific young audience of readers who are struggling with learning to read. So it was a bit specialized. And we just sort of said yes, took it on. And we had a great collaborative process with Noémie Berlus and Facile à lire, which in French means easy to read. And then I was on the phone with another contact. It's just funny because, again, nobody has stories like this. I don't know how it happened. It was really coincidental. So this was a woman who I had published a short story with several years before. And I think I was submitting my novel to her at the time. And so we were on the phone and it didn't end up working for one reason or another. And she said, yeah, you know, we're really looking to publish some children's books. And, you know, we're having trouble finding LGBTQ authors who want to tackle, you know, those issues, but from a children's perspective. Do you know anyone? And I said, well, Lucy and I are working on this high-low chapter book for Facile à lire. What do you think? And she said, send us some proposals. So we sent some proposals and they actually wanted two. We had a picture book that ended up being called The Loudest Bark, which was about a non-binary character. And of course, it has dogs in it, which is the best thing about it. And the second book was a middle grade novel called My Sister's Girlfriend, which was told from the point of view of the sibling of a teenager who ends up falling in love with another girl. So that was how those books. So no submission, no intention of writing kid lit, nothing. It really, they just kind of landed in our pandemic laps. So that's how those two books came to be.
It seems like they were manifested somehow. Like it's like kind of coming out of thin air a little bit, but you know, right place, right time, right circumstances. And you know, you had the foresight to, you know, follow up on, or just, you know, present yourself as an opportunity. And it seemed,
we just said yes.
Yeah.
It was just one of those. Yeah, it was, and it had that kind of strange alternative reality that a lot of the stuff during the pandemic had, you know, and some of which was hard and some of which was very special and very precious, actually.
Right. So
that was that category.
Yeah. I was going to say, for all the aspiring authors out there, it's easy. I mean, it's just, you just have to open yourself up to the possibilities and they'll just present themselves to you. It happens all the time.
Oh, I wish.
As I say, yeah. With just a little bit of sarcasm.
Right. But I do think the more people that you know, and the more, like I was doing a lot of volunteer work at the time, and that was how I knew Noémie. We knew each other from homeschooling, but I was volunteering for that organization doing copy editing, copywriting for them. So I do think if you're out there, you're volunteering, you're mixing with people who are other writers and editors and publishers. And again, not in a manipulative, leechy kind of way, but just in a genuine, like, I love doing this and here I am. And I do think that things come up and interesting opportunities do present themselves.
Well, I think that's an important point to make. I mean, a lot of people think that writing, and to some extent, you know, sometimes writing is, you know, people hold up in a cabin in the woods or doing something solitary, but there is that aspect to it of networking and being out there and being part of the community. And I think maybe that's it, you know, being part of it, the writing and publishing community and getting yourself out there and getting yourself in front of people is a big part of it. You know, it's not just about the talent you have. It's about, you know, how do you get out there and meet people and network and have these opportunities, you know, come to you. Because if you're just sitting in your home and not doing anything, you might have all the talent in the world, but that doesn't guarantee that anyone's going to see what you've got. So.
And it's hard because it's really a different skill set. And I happen to be fairly extroverted and it's still hard for me.
Oh, sure.
And then there's this whole thing of building a platform and it's a huge, huge task. But again, just think about it in terms of, what do I love to do? How do I want to share my skills? How do I want to, build community in a way that's natural, organic, authentic? Then it becomes a little easier as opposed to I'm trying to sell my book, which is, I mean, that's a no starter for me.
Yeah, it is overwhelming. And yeah, you're right. I mean, the first thing agents and publishers want to know is, well, what is this new author's platform? And it's a catch 22, because if you're a new author, you don't have a huge platform. You don't have a long, you know, you don't have a big mailing list. You know, you don't have necessarily the big following on social media. So it is tough. It is hard, but you've got to put yourself out there. So what can you share with us about Falling Through the Night?
Yeah, it's funny. I was a little ahead of myself. So those essays on queer motherhood, that was my idea for, let's put those together and have a collection for my first book. And it just wasn't working. I just wasn't finding a through line that was strong and I was really struggling. And I hired a developmental editor who I had met when I was in Canada, a feminist, lesbian feminist author I really admired named Betsy Moreland. And we had an appointment and she's old fashioned. So she actually had made all of her notes on a physical copy of the manuscript. So I remember we were sitting around her apartment and there were papers everywhere. And, you know, I was feeling a little bit overwhelmed and she was sort of looking for something she had written. And she kind of, something jogged her memory or gave her this thought. And I just remember she kind of looked up kind of quizzically and she asked me, do you think that this material might want to be a novel? And I was instantly seized with, like, I was terrified and kind of thrilled at the same time, because I always thought there's no way I could write a novel. It's too hard. It's too big. It's too long. I wouldn't know what I'm doing. That's what real writers do. I mean, every single insecurity that could possibly exist was in my body at that moment. But it was really the right question, because that was what jumpstarted the process and made it make sense. And part of it was, I just wasn't that interested in myself as a topic. But the idea of taking some of these experiences and kind of placing them as a structure on a fictional character and then developing that character in her world, that was thrilling. So yeah, that's, and then 8 years later.
Eight short years.
Yeah.
How did you, you know, overcome that initial reaction of, I can't write a novel? It's too big. There's too much work. How did you sort of overcome that? You know, when you really started to take this, you know, seriously.
It's a really good question, Mike. There's part of me that's a little bit reckless, I guess would be the word, where if something resonates strongly enough in me, even my insecurities just aren't strong enough to prevent me from saying yes. I think that's something I learned from theater, the power of saying yes. There's this thing when you do improvisation, you're supposed to say yes. So if someone brings an element into the scene, like somebody has says, this is my pet bird. You can't say, what pet bird?
Right.
Because, you know, it can't be seen. So you have to integrate it. So that there's something about that philosophy that I take to heart in my life, and it does not always serve me well. But in this particular situation, it did. It served me very well, because it just seemed so perfect. Like, I knew intuitively that there was, and I didn't know I was going to publish it. I didn't know it was going to come out well, but I knew I wanted to try. I was excited enough about the idea. So it was just sort of following that intuition and passion. And there were many points along the way where I was like, oh, this sucks. I can't do it. Like, it's too hard. It's not making sense. It's too complicated. I can't make all the points, all the things added up. I just felt so inept at certain points along the way. But again, that idea that there was still something, my characters were so exciting. I loved them. I loved them from the beginning, all of them. As soon as they popped into the manuscript, I just would fall in love with them. And I kind of didn't want to like let them down.
Right. That's interesting. You're not letting not wanting to let those characters down. It's sort of some kind of motivation to keep going when your mood is getting a little dark, or when you're questioning your abilities. And I imagine there's a lot of readers out there who are happy you didn't let those characters down. I'm thinking about, you saying, the person saying, would this want to be a novel? And I thought that was an interesting phrasing. It's like, you're asking a manuscript if it wants to be a novel, it's like, it's not a human being, but, in a way, writing fiction kind of takes a little, it still requires a fair amount of vulnerability to write fiction. I mean, obviously, if you're writing, memoir, it's your story. So it's kind of out there. And fiction, I do believe we leave a little bit of ourselves on every page, even when we write fiction. But there is a wall there a little bit, though, where you're not necessarily telling your story, but you can still convey the principles you believe in through fiction. Do you feel like you've done that through Falling Through the Night, where you're able to sort of, use it as sort of a way of kind of expressing your beliefs and your worldview?
I would say yes. I think one of the things that I've found in my own life is that being close to people and having genuinely close, healthy connections, it's like the soil that allows plants to grow. Like the growth and the development of a person is sort of inevitable if you have those connections. It's very natural. And I was very interested in how this idea of chosen family could be that kind of soil. That's how it's been for me. That's definitely how it is for my main character, Audrey. Mm-hmm. And she's a different generation than I am. I was curious about that too. I think the social relationship to mental health has changed a lot. I'm in my late 50s. Audrey's in her 30s, and growing up with a psychiatric diagnosis has a very different meaning now. I think the younger people are more accepting. There's less stigma. It's also a little bit more medicalized. And I think that can go both ways. And that was an interesting dynamic to explore, as well as the way that you can really internalize an identity like that. And I was curious about exploring that as well.
Well, I know we kind of jumped into how the book came to be and like the book's backstory, but I don't know that we talked about like what the book itself is about. So what can you share with us about sort of the overall story and who Audrey is?
Well, Audrey Meyerowitz is a 30-something. She's queer. She has generalized anxiety disorder, and she's also adopted. And the book begins with her and her best friend, Jessica, who's a recovering alcoholic. And they have gone through 3 years of a women's wellness program for women with mental health issues of all kinds. And there's a lot of support and a lot of teaming and a lot of multi kind of healing on different levels. And Audrey really longs to have a family of her own. She wants to have a wife and kids, and that's her dream, but it's really feels out of reach because her love life has been kind of full of nightmare girlfriends and all kinds of panic attacks and things that interfere with that dream. And Jessica says, well, I made you a profile on She Loves Her, which is the queer platform that they have in their just at whatever. That's the queer platform. So, and Audrey's very resistant. She's very introverted, but she says, okay, fine. And then the book takes place during the Trump administration. And there's all that talk about axing the Affordable Care Act. And Audrey gets nervous about what would happen if she loses all her services. So she gets this idea that maybe if she meets a woman in Canada, which is not very far from Vermont, maybe she could go there and she would have health insurance paid for. So it's kind of a little bit of a crazy idea. And her best friend's kind of against it. But she ends up meeting a woman from Canada and she does fall in love. And then this is her story of taking that journey through that relationship and what happens when she gets there and the people that she meets. And she goes through all kinds of different adventures as she embarks on that quest for a family of her own.
All right. You know, you mentioned that she is adopted. And you also mentioned, you know, giving up a son or a child for adoption. Is there a link there? I mean, was it important for you to have sort of that adopted that adoption as an element in the story?
Well, Audrey ends up giving a twin away. That's the closest to my story that the book ends up following. But I had a girlfriend of mine that a partner who was adopted, and that was about 15 years ago, or 20 years ago, anyway. But I was curious because she had a lot of adoption trauma. And that was the first that I had heard about that. I didn't know anything about the experience of being an adoptee. And I thought that it would be very interesting if I made that part of Audrey's experience of giving the twin away that had Down syndrome and how that ultimately connects back to some questions about her birth story. And that's a big part of the plot. So it is connected. Yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of makes it, you know, authentic in a way, because, you know, it's something that you've experienced and yeah, that's wild. So let's talk a little bit about, Judaism. I know, you know, one thing that I believe you share with Audrey is Judaism. And just talk to me a little bit about how Judaism is represented in the story.
Audrey is Jewish and she's adopted. And that's problematic because in the Jewish religion, the religion passes from the mother. So the fact that she is connected as a cultural Jew, she's not necessarily observant, but she has a Star of David that's very important to her from her mom, and she's attached to her cultural identity as a Jewish woman. And her best friend Jessica has been very adamant about Audrey. You should be looking for your birth family. You should be trying to reach out and connect with the people who gave birth to you. And one of the things that she says is, don't you want to know if you're really Jewish? And Audrey kind of flips her lid. Oh, my mother's Jewish and Martha's is real. And that thought penetrates. And then when Audrey does end up getting curious about that later in the book, she finds out, some information about her birth parents, and it ties into Judaism. Mm-hmm. So it does end up being a big part of her story that she actually didn't know anything about.
Yeah, it's a. Yeah. Oh, we won't go into too much more detail because we want people to discover that for themselves.
Yeah. That was so much fun to figure out for myself as an author, as a plot point. Again, because I was thinking about that idea and how, because I don't ascribe to that belief. I feel like if you're Jewish, however you got there, that's up to you to decide. But it is a big thing in the religion. And I was curious about how those, I don't know, mythologies, not quite the right word, but how those elements of culture can work on a person and make them question, well, am I really Jewish? And what does that mean? Right. So it connected really well to that story.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. One way I like to get to know my guests a little bit more is through asking a couple of pop culture questions. And I'm curious, Gail, when you were growing up, what were some of your favorite things to watch on TV? Did you have any favorite TV shows as a kid?
Oh, man. I loved I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched.
There are two shows certainly in the same vein, right? Certainly in the same vein, you know, to me, they're both great, but I have a question for you with Bewitched: new Darren or old Darren, or do you?
Oh, new Darren. Definitely. That's Sergeant.
Dick Sergeant. Yeah.
Sergeant versus York. Yeah. Sergeant. Yeah, for sure. And everyone has an opinion about that who watched the show, right?
I remember probably 15 years ago when the movie came out with Nicole Kidman and Will Ferrell. I had such high hopes for Bewitched, the movie. And it just, aside from like an argument they had on screen about hummus, to me, the movie kind of fell flat. Like it was not the greatest. I think maybe something should stay in the 60s and 70s. Maybe that's the lesson learned there.
It's totally of its time. I didn't even know there was a movie.
Oh, yeah. It was Will Ferrell and and Nicole Kidman. And you know, it's got a couple laughs, but I expected a tad more from it. Then again, I expected a tad more from the Chips movie that came out about 5 or 6 years ago. And I love Dax Shepard, but it lost something, you know, the campiness of Ponch and John and from the 70s and early 80s. I don't know.
Context is everything.
It really is. It really is. How about music? What did you like listening to growing up?
What did I like? I love Broadway musicals. That was my favorite thing. So like the music from Pippin, Fiddler on the Roof, Godspell, even some of the old ones, South Pacific, Sound of Music. Any musical, I would listen to the records over and over. I'd memorize all the words. I'd get my Coke can microphone and pretend that I was the lead and belting them out.
Now, the big question, somewhat inappropriate perhaps, is did you walk around singing, "I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair" from South Pacific around your house? Or did you change the lyrics at some point?
Yeah, I think that didn't resonate very well.
maybe not. I remember I was in a production. I think I was backstage running the lighting or sound. I can't remember, for my high school's production of South Pacific. So those numbers are still in my head. Still stuck in my head.
Can't get them out.
No, I can't wash them out of my hair. terrible. How about biggest things you've learned about yourself, you know, as a writer through writing? What are any big insights you've come to about yourself?
It's a good one. I think the biggest surprise is that I'm so much more capable than I thought I was. And I think a lot of that is patience. I think I don't think of myself as a patient person, and a lot of the time I'm not, but I think I have a patience for a very long process and the willpower to just continue sitting down and, you know, meeting the manuscripts on its own terms and taking a little bit at a time. And it was a surprise. The fact that I can pick this up and say, I wrote this. This is my book with my name on it. Like it still stuns me. It's still really shocking. But a lot of that is just, again, I never thought I would have the patience. And then part of me also just doubted that I had the skill. And apparently someone thought I did.
Now I have to ask, because I'm sure there's a lot of people listening who doubt their own skills and abilities to put pen to paper and bring it out into the world. What advice would you give them, you know, if they're feeling a little bit down and if the wind's out of their sails? How would you put wind back in their sails?
Well, something I love is the story of J.K. Rowling, and that she submitted, what was it, like 12 times before she got a publishing deal. I just think knowing that even the most famous and lucrative writers with the best careers, they've struggled and they've had those confidence issues and they haven't had things go their way and they've had people be very discouraging to them. And I think if you keep your eye on your work and say and keeping track of your small wins, that's something I always tell my students, your small wins, we are not trained to do that in our lives. We're trained to honor the big stuff, but like I met my writing commitments this week, 2 out of 3 days. Celebrate that, especially if it's better than you did the week before. And just take those small steps, one step, and to love the process. If you love the process, you will learn and you'll grow. And it's an exciting thing. It's an exciting thing to engage in, to be a writer, even if you never make a cent out of it. You know, just meeting other writers and talking about work and immersing yourself in stories, it's thrilling.
I love this notion of keeping track of small wins. And it brings me to like my Apple Watch, right? Which tells me every day if I close my rings. So I have, you know, my exercise ring, you know, whatever it is, 45 minutes a day, standing, you know, at least once every 12 hours. And then I think there's calorie burning or whatever. So I set those every day and the watch judges me at the end of the day and says, hey, you didn't hit this goal, you know, Mike, stand more or whatever. But we can, just as we set these sort of movement goals through these devices, we could set writing goals too, you know, X number of words a day or a week or X number of pages or whatever it is. I think that's great. And that sort of holds you accountable to the action.
And I think going along with that is to not do it alone, to do it with other people in some way. Like I'm a member of Inked Voices, which is an online writing community. And there's just so many different ways that you can, even just checking in with someone or doing a write-in, you know, where you just are on Zoom and there's a bunch of people writing and you don't even talk about what you wrote. It's just a way to keep accountable. I think if you're connected with other people who are doing it, it's more likely you'll do it yourself and it's going to be more fun.
Yeah. I love it. I love that. And Inked Voices, by the way, could also be, you know, a group of heavily tattooed writers. I mean, that it could be. You never know. Like,
it might end up being that. Actually, they're having an in-person writing retreat. It's the first time I will have met several people that I've known online for many years. And maybe we'll all go get tattoos.
Or now that you're seeing them for more than just like the neck up, you might find that they all have sleeves, like tattooed sleeves. They might be heavily tattooed and you just never knew it.
That's it. I got to catch up.
It could happen. It could happen.
I don't have
my final one for you is if you could go back in time and whisper some words of advice into the younger Gail. Maybe it's that, you know, that 4-year-old Gail who is passing notes to her therapist under an easel. What would you tell your younger self?
I would tell her that she's very lovable. In spite of what she's learning in her family, she's very lovable.
I kind of reinforce that there's a worth there.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
All right. Give her a big hug.
And that someday she will be able to have animals in her life.
Now, how many animals do you have? I mean, we've seen one cat go by, but
I just have a kitty cat, but I've had different cats and dogs in my life, and it's been a total joy. I was a big animal lover as a child, but that just wasn't part of our family.
It's the only love you can buy is an animal, I think. A pet is what I like to say anyway. Gail, if people want to find out more about you, do you have a website or Instagram, Twitter, any of those social media platforms? Can people follow you?
Yep. GailMarleneSchwartz.com is my website, and GailMarleneSchwartz author for Instagram and Facebook, I believe.
Very good. Very good. Well, Gail, thank you so much for dropping by Uncorking a Story and letting me uncork yours.
Thank you, Mike. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to Uncorking a Story. If you'd like more information about today's guest or to find out more about Mike, go to uncorkingastory.com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tune in every week to hear Mike Carlin uncork a new story.